Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Well, wow. I need my wonderful audience today. I've just been through an emotional up and down ringer watching from 3 to 4, just before the show, the Dr. Oz show, in which I was the opening picture, one of the opening photos, so to speak. Whoa, wow. I'm really glad you're there. I need to debrief. I need to be with you and talk with you for a few minutes. And I've got a wonderful guest following. And let me just check that he's there. Tom, are you there?
Peter, I am definitely here.
Okay. Well, my friend, I'm going to take a couple of minutes and debrief what just went on Dr. Oz, although it will take me a longer time to grasp it. Let me start with the good news. There was a Dr. Oz show today, which the intelligent listener could watch and realize that psychiatric drugs are a part of most school shootings. Because at one point, after all his rebuttal experts sitting up there in their shiny faces and their shiny suits and their shiny background, after they got through talking about how NAS, no such thing as drugs in school shootings, drugs and violence, he lifted up a sheet of paper and said, well, I just had my staff go and look at just from the newspapers, so the association between psychiatric drugs and school shootings. And this is what we found just from the newspapers. And he said, it looks like just about all of these were associated with antidepressants, and then later came out also benzos and maybe some other drugs. Well, that's worth years of work. And looking at how bad, horrific, and tragic the show was overall, all I can hope is that, yes, maybe all the work I did, maybe talking with the producer of the show at some length, maybe sending them articles, maybe all of that did at least bring about a Dr. Oz show raising these issues in which he at times showed and probably maybe genuine concern that maybe there was a connection between psychiatric drugs and mass violence. As the show unfolded, it was quite interesting. First, they start with some sort of a hype about, is there violence and drugs connections? And then they had me on Skype. I should have known that was a bad sign because they got their panel there in New York. I don't know wherever they are. I volunteered to come wherever they were. And then they had marvelous Kelly Brogan on explaining that these drugs were psychiatrist in New York. She's been on the show. She'll be on again. Talking about how these drugs were so bad and, yes, associated with violence that she doesn't give them anymore. But all they had me saying is, yeah, there's a direct connection or something like that. I don't even remember what I said because it was so short. Then the panel began. And it displayed every unethical, fraudulent thing that professionals can say, and I'm not going to name them by names or gender or whatever their scorecard on the professional ladder or whatever, but I made some notes on the kind of things that came out in defense of the drugs. First, the constant repetition, the treatment works, with no evidence, of course, provided. Then Oz saying, and what I've seen from scientific studies is undertreatment might lead to violence. Undertreatment, not giving a big enough dose or not giving the right dose. At one point, he even mentioned the right cocktail. He used the word the right cocktail later in the show. Well, one of the defenders, there were three of them there, I think, one of the defenders said of the psychiatric drugs, as if this made some huge difference, that, well, if a person did get violent on a psychiatric drug, they were just being energized to bring out their true personality. Well, first of all, even if that's true, would that matter to the person they killed? Or if they killed themselves? Should that matter to society? That the drug just revealed their true nature? What kind of thinking is that? Wow. But it even got more interesting. And these just notes I took down literally the heat of passion, because the show was not even over at last 5 minutes when I left to make sure I wasn't late for my marvelous, wonderful, thank God you're there, audience. Because today I do need you to talk to. Then someone else admitted, but listen, you know, I mean, that did let people know that these drugs might bring out the true personality of people when they were murderers. I'm sure that wasn't as reassuring to the American public as it was to the doctor. Then, whether it was a doctor or not, I don't know. Then another thing that came out was, well, if you give antidepressants to a bipolar patient, which, by the way, happens all the time, that could lead to violence. And then this individual said, and that's pretty much a quote, but that's not the drug, that's the doctor. So if the doctor makes a mistake and gives the antidepressant to a bipolar patient, which is done a lot and should never be done, then it's not the drug. Imagine that. We're so defending the drug. It's the doctor. And of course, treatment does work. Treatment does work. We heard that again and again. Another doctor raised the issue of benzos, because some of this list that the Dr. Oz raised had benzos on. He said, well, you know, even taking a benzo once, I'm very surprised by this, you know, just shows worse outcomes, and that benzodiazepines may result in worse outcomes. I don't know whether he clearly, it was announced that he had worked for drug companies. I don't know whether he still does. Maybe they didn't make benzos. And he said that if you withdraw rapidly from benzos, that could lead to violence. So again, this stuff kept creeping in, these warnings, but the treatment works. Then Dr. Oz actually put up a formal statement from pharma, the big national organization, the pharmaceutical companies. And then, by the way, I was only on for that one little clip in the beginning, but I do think I influenced the existence of the show and maybe those little baby steps that Dr. Oz was taking. And then the show added on this sad, sad note, this horrible thing that my colleagues do, which is to bring onto the stage some lovely looking person who is clearly sad and clearly drugged. But they don't want to deal with that. No, they had her explain how she had 15 different drugs. First of all, that she was a happy person on drugs, but then she asked her doctor to take her off, and he did. We don't know how he took her off. Weaned, what does that mean? That usually means, you know, 2 days. And then this, she said that she got sicker and went into her undergraduate years, was horribly tortured and horribly suicidal. And I'm sure that happens, and that's true, because I see people like that all the time in my work. We all do see people who are tortured. Some of us have been tortured earlier in our lives by horrible thoughts and have found a way out through a lot better roads than psychiatric drugs. And then she went on to say something that was so misleading that Oz allowed this to go on. It was a tragedy. She said, then I had genetic testing. And then he said, oh, yes, we now have genetic testing, which is so helpful with us in the treating our depressed patients. This is Dr. Oz. And then she says, this genetic testing told me I was missing two enzymes, or two something, two genetic, maybe I had two genetic defects, something like that, that so that my serotonin didn't function right, so that I was in a chronic state of depression with my normal brain, with my brain as it was. And they found the right drugs to give me. And then lo and behold, I don't know if it's the head or one of the heads of a pharmaceutical company is there, and the name is given out. He says, we're so grateful to help. And then he gives a brief explanation. And all he's explaining is what we've known for decades, which is some people don't metabolize some of the drugs. So it's totally misleading what the girl had been told, what she said to the public was totally misleading. And so we gave her a drug, what? That they knew wasn't being metabolized. They gave her a good dose, probably, is what they did. They gave her a drug that wasn't, you know, that wasn't going to be dealt with by the brain by, you know, either letting it get too high or too low. Who knows what was going on? But, I mean, that's all it was. They just gave her a drug that somehow... she had the proper genes for its metabolism. I mean, and that doesn't mean anything. All it means is maybe you're getting the intended dose. And you can be sure that among all those 15 other drugs she was getting somewhere, she got the intended dose rather than a lower dose. Unless, God forbid, they were trying to manipulate her so that she would get a higher dose. But it had nothing to do with the serotonin in her brain, nothing to do with synapses, nothing to do with diagnosing depression, nothing to do with why she was depressed for years. It wasn't the natural state of her brain. That Oz permitted that to go on reminded me that he also had a pro-electroshock show, which Ginger reminded me at the end. So there is, folks. And overall, I don't think we could have had this show a few years ago. I do think that this show was an advance. They did have me up there. They did have Kelly Brogan. They've been keeping people like us off the air entirely. Somebody could reel back, you know, and find one or both of us. And she looked great. I got to improve my equipment. But, you know, big TV doesn't usually Skype me. They, you know, they bring me in. So that's the situation, and maybe my friend Tom Moore, who's now going to come on, can perk me up and give us some insight, make some comments, maybe let me let off some more steam. I've known Tom Moore forever. He's been on the show several times. He's at the Institute for Safety Medication Practices. It's a nonprofit. Thomas J. Moore, he puts out a publication called Quarter Watch, which has important good analyses of serious adverse drug effects, including those that are coming out of the Food and Drug Administration. He's also a lecturer in the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics, which gives him a IQ 20 points higher than mine, I'm sure, at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. He's an adjunct at South Carolina College of Pharmacy. I mean, it'd be interesting to see how he put together these things. But he was, I know, a long time at GW before he became involved with and I believe set up the Safe Medication Practices, a nonprofit. If I'm wrong about that, he'll correct me. And
he's well, yes, Peter.
Okay.
It's a pleasure to be here. The Institute for Safe Medication Practices has been around for 30 years.
And okay.
Their main focus is on safe medication use. How do we prevent people from being hurt for the wrong dose, wrong drug, wrong patient? And ISMP has about 35 staffers, and they're up in the suburbs of Philadelphia.
Oh, wow. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. You're punching
me up. And publications for hospital pharmacists, for consumers, for pharmacists. I do a little something different, Peter. I do drug safety, which is not wrong patient, wrong dose. That is, how do we identify the problems? How do we manage the risks of drugs? And I'm particularly interested, as you know, and you're partly responsible for it, in psychiatric drugs. And we might even pick up our conversation about talking about what is the straight talk about how well antidepressant drugs actually work.
Go for that, because we just heard such a bunch of junk on the Dr. Oz show. Treatment works. Tell us how well antidepressant treatment works.
So I published two very lengthy papers on this. So here's sort of the story. The debate about antidepressant drugs, it's funny because it's gone. I've been involved in it now for 20 years. When I started working on antidepressant drugs, the tests on your psychiatry boards, the textbooks all said antidepressants are highly effective, will produce remission or substantial relief in 60%. I used to, of patients, and that was what the doctors were being taught. That these are, and of course there were books like Listening to Prozac that made it sound like it's almost a miracle. So we've come the full circle, and if for those of you who read, there was an article in the New York Times. Everybody has been talking about a new study that came out in Lancet about 2 weeks ago, and it's very funny because it was saying, hey, antidepressant drugs work. After all, they're not worthless, which is sort of a funny cycle for the whole debate to go through. And so this was a study in Lancet, and it's sort of worth our talking about because this is sort of where the debate is. And it included some famous scientists, actually, and they said that they looked at, unbelievably, over 500 clinical trials of antidepressant drugs, and they scored every one of them, and they found a drug effect. And so the sort of hype mill said, guess what, antidepressant drugs work after all. Well, now, I don't actually know any serious scientist who says that antidepressant drugs don't work at all, so it's sort of a straw man to start with. What most people, and what I certainly have said, is that their effects are very marginal at best. So I would just sort of like to go into, well, so they said, well, actually, they all worked. So there were two or three things wrong with this whole idea. The first thing is you have to, how do you decide whether the drug works or not? Well, it turns out that these people selected an endpoint the FDA would never allow for approval. And that was, it's sort of interesting, quote, a response. Now, what is a response to the drug? You got to stick with me. This is a little tricky. Response means that your depression score went down 50% in 6 weeks. Sounds pretty reasonable, doesn't it? Okay, but then here's their transformation. Suppose that we had a trial that was a total bust, and we had 100 patients, and only 5 of them on the drug responded. So that's 5 responders. Got that? So, and then we had a placebo group for comparison, and 4 of them responded. So what's the benefit of the drug, according to this study? That would be a, quote, relative benefit of 1.25. Now, what it's concealing is the fact is hardly anybody responded to it. So they didn't measure it right. The second problem, which is this is the new sort of study that's everyone is talking about, is, well, is it impressive because it included 500 trials? And my answer is, the opposite. No. Simply slapping in a bunch of half-baked trials where a medical investigator who was giving talks in favor of antidepressants got a grant and wrote up a study of 60 patients. Throwing those into the mix, in my view, accomplishes nothing. That the proper way to go about that is to take a look only at, to look at all the studies that passed muster at the FDA, and you get a different answer. So let's cut it down to simply, where do we really come at today? about how well antidepressant drugs work. First, one way, and this is something that I reported some years ago, one way of saying it is actually after 6 weeks, there's a substantial improvement in people who take antidepressants for 6 weeks. Substantial. But 82% of that effect was duplicated in the placebo group. Another way of looking at it, which we also published, is it has a, whether or not there's even that small sliver of benefit depends on the severity of the depression. In mild depression, and it's not even tested in that group anymore, there really has been no effect found. In moderate depression, a small effect, and virtually all of the effect, such as there is, was found in those who were severely depressed. Another simple way, and I'm sorry to give you so many numbers, but whether it is the first trials of Prozac back in 1984, or the most recently improved and widely advertised Trintellix antidepressant approved in 2015 or 16, about 40% of the trials where they're trying to show there was an effect failed to show a benefit. It was true in 1984. It was true in 2015. So that's my take on antidepressants. And then there is the problem of harms. There is the problem of withdrawal symptoms. And so you have to balance a very small amount of benefit against some fairly substantial risks, other major risks, sexual dysfunction, weight gain. And then the harder, the tougher one, which is where you started, which was violence. And those are much, when we look at suicides and violence, they are much rarer. It's much harder to get a good measure of it. So that's my take on antidepressants. That's what the evidence, and when this study was saying, well, they don't work at all, I think they were really sort of bouncing off these studies that I and my co-authors, the big one is Irving Kirsch, have written over quite a few years.
Thank you. Thank you. Let me embellish a few thoughts about all this just to remind people. First of all, folks, these studies that maybe are marginally effective, but only with people who are described as especially depressed, the extreme group, those studies are 6 weeks long, 4 weeks long, maybe occasionally 8 weeks long. Often the patients don't have enough patients at the end of 6 weeks to do something statistically significant, so they go back and they make believe, they have statistical ways of bringing forward the patients as if they were still in the study or other shenanigans. But basically these studies often have such high dropout rates that from the adverse effects and from the lack of a good effect. So that's one. Number two is, of course, they're conducted by people paid by the drug companies, and they're based on protocols, that is the plan that the FDA approves, that is written by the drug company under FDA supervision, and that has a lot of tricks in it. The FDA allows a lot of tricks. For example, they will give all the patients placebo, everybody. They take them off their own drugs, which puts them in withdrawal, even in a lot of the antidepressant studies. So they take them off their drugs, puts them into withdrawal. And then if a patient responds to the placebo, they drop them out. So they purposely skew the study so that patients who do respond to a sugar pill aren't in the study. When I first saw that, folks, I researched the whole literature. I couldn't find a single person. I may have been the first person in print to criticize that and talking back to Prozac. I don't know. but at the time, I didn't see anybody even look at that kind of a bizarre issue. A number of people that Tom and I know and respect have come out and said, a couple of psychiatrists, that in fact, the slight marginal improvement is not clinically significant. It's just meaningless in these studies. And I would add quite a bit to to the adverse effect issues. in one of the studies used to get approval of Prozac for children, there are only two studies, and one of them, which was carried out by huge promoters of the drugs, 6% of the children dropped out due to bipolar episodes. That is, they became manic on the drug. 6%. The only reason I found it is that that was mentioned a couple of years earlier, when the study was going on, in a little newspaper report about a discussion at the meetings. So I went and I looked, and the only place I found it was not under the introduction, the abstract, the clinical discussion. It's under a little thing about why do patients drop out, because 6% of the kids are having manic episodes, which can include psychosis. Tom, you want to say something? Please, go ahead.
I do want to say a little something about that, which is this is another issue that has been clearly documented now over about 20 years, and it's not simply limited to children. Around 1% of treated antidepressant patients, around 1%, maybe a little less than 1%, when treated with a depression, become bipolar. And it's very interesting because you can find it in the FDA reviews. If you dig deep enough into the data, it's there, and sometimes it's in the product labels. But then there are these elaborate maneuvers to explain that, well, this wasn't causing it. It was merely unmasking for the first time pre-existing bipolar disease. Now, which is sort of torturous logic. So it's not just
that's what we heard on the show today, was that it was bringing out their violent personality, like
unmasking.
Oh, well, God. Go ahead.
I have, if you wanted to sort of circle back to the violence, I have sort of two different sorts of stories.
Wait. You've written the best study on violence. So, which they did not. They should have interviewed you, and they should have brought up your study. Why don't we go right to your study on violence? That the best study, that the most important study has been done, is yours. So let's go talk about that, Tom. I've mentioned it on the show.
Well,
I've mentioned it in my books.
I've actually done a couple, two or three different ones. But I think that actually for radio. What got me interested in the violence was actually a story that a psychiatrist told me about one of his patients. And it's about actually a benzodiazepine, which maybe this audience would call a tranquilizer, drugs like alprazolam. So let me just talk about what does a violence event look like, which has fascinated me for years. So, and this is a pretty good one. So there was this guy, again, he would fall probably in your children. He was about 17, 18 years old. And he was at his girlfriend's apartment. And for the first time, he took her he was having trouble to sleeping. He might have had a drink, might have had a beer, not a lot. And so he took one of her benzodiazepines. He went to sleep for about 20 minutes. And then he awoke in a highly agitated state, went to the closet and took out a baseball bat from the softball game they had played that afternoon. And he didn't touch his girlfriend. He went downstairs and started smashing the windshield of his own car to pieces. Needless to say, that brought the police out. There's this guy smashing the windshield of a car. And he was in such a violent frenzy that he hit the policeman so hard he broke his jaw. I did another study, which I did do a study that says, what do violent events associated with the stop smoking drug Chantix look like? And that was the benzodiazepine, but this gives you a little look at what I've learned about violence and drugs. So the Chantix, again, these drugs are different, and you can't just automatically assume that the events associated with one kind of drug are going to apply to the other. This is just what I've learned. So Chantix drugs. What does a violent event look like? We analyzed in depth 26 cases. So the first thing, like the guy with the baseball bat, people got into trouble with this drug almost as soon as they took the first dose. With Chantix, it was interesting because it started at only a quarter of what the general treatment dose, and then it gets ramped up. So the first thing is it seemed to be a problem almost immediately. It's also been seen with dose increases. The events that we looked at for Chantix is absolutely senseless. It made no sense for this person. You know, a woman held a gun, a shotgun on her 90-year-old mother. A woman woke up her boyfriend, fiancé, and started hitting him because he looked so peaceful. The third characteristic was that the victim was just anybody nearby. Didn't matter. It could be fiancé, 90-year-old mother, policeman. Another guy started slugging some people at a bowling alley he'd never met before. And, of course, in the 26 cases we looked at, none of these individuals had any other psychiatric, were completely stable on other psychiatric drugs, and none of them had any history of violence. So that is sort of what I've learned about, for at least some drugs, about what drug-induced violence look like. They're fairly rare. There could be a whole bunch of other cases. I tried very hard to see if we could get, there was a huge settlement in the case of Chantix of 3,000 cases of Chantix, which is either suicide or violence, mostly suicide, but some of both. And everybody was paid. It was a several hundred million dollar settlement. And I really wanted to study those cases and say, what can we learn about this? What was the vulnerability? Do people who react badly to benzodiazepines or Chantix also, maybe it's a genetic thing and they're reacting badly to any to antidepressant drugs as well? So much we could learn about this if we would just get out of denial and say, this is the real deal. Drugs can induce bizarre behaviors and sometimes violent behaviors. And rather than saying it doesn't happen, or let's pretend it doesn't happen, what we need to say is, how does it happen and why does it happen and how do we prevent it?
I had on the air, I don't know if you, I think you've talked to him. I know you have. Andrew Thibault. His last name is spelled Thibault. Andrew is from Florida, and he actually went to court to force the and again, the show is February 14th. You can find it easily on Bregan.com. And he had to force the FDA through a court to release the clinical information behind the summaries that they send out with when you request adverse effects. Folks, when you can write to the FDA and say, give me 5 years of adverse effects so summarized, and you'll get a few lines back about a whole bunch of drug adverse effects, maybe a couple of thousand or more. And you can search them, and they can also send them to you organized by the reported adverse effect, like violence. And he's finding a lot of reports of violence, but in the summaries, and then the FDA broke its normal practice, wouldn't send him the little summaries about the violence. And he finally got all those. He's sitting on all that information. It'd be interesting, Tom, to put you together with him and maybe help him organize that information. But have you met him?
I haven't, but let me update a little bit. You, what you said is all correct, but that also the world of adverse event disclosure, which is what I do, has changed a little bit. You can now go on, actually, there are two ways you can look at adverse drug event reports, including ones about violence. There's something that are called computer excerpts. They are pretty simple. They have some terms in them, but for privacy reasons, the narrative of the full story of what happened is not provided. Now, you can go on the FDA adverse event dashboard, and you can go get those. You can go get those yourself. They're kind of hard to read. It's not the easiest to read, but you can have it right away. Or you can write a FOIA to them, and they'll send you a printout in 3 weeks easily. Harder is to get, and what I think you were talking about, much harder is to get the narrative, the storytelling of what really happened, like what I was talking to you about with the Chantix cases. And for those, and I can't remember, for those, you might have to, one, you don't want to, it takes the FDA 15 minutes of staff time per report. So if you went and asked them for 1,000 reports, and this was part of the issue in that case, if you went and asked them for 1,000 violence reports, so that's 1,000 times 15 minutes, that's, so they're going to be reluctant to provide that many cases. But if you can winnow it down, I think I asked for 75 cases, and 26 turned out to be to meet our criteria. You can get those narratives, but you do have to be selective. I'll have to say the FDA doesn't do too bad a job at trying to get that information out the door.
Well, you and I have always had slightly different feelings about the FDA, although I have to agree with you that the people I've spoken to at the FDA to get information have always been very helpful to me, always. So in that we certainly would agree. One of the things that came out that Andrew talked about on the show, I believe, is that, and again, that's the February 14th show of this year, is that the FDA, when asked, you know, what did these violence reports show, they said, we haven't looked at them. So imagine that. You're getting hundreds and hundreds of reports of violence on your drugs. The research of Tom Moore, our guest, has shown that you can actually find patterns of violence that are specific to certain drugs, including antidepressants and benzos, probably as a group, and specific drugs that he can name. Chantix was the top drug, actually, in that study by Tom. Well, why hasn't the FDA done it? Why didn't they take your study and then say, whoa, look at this data. Well, let's look at violence.
Well, I have a couple of answers to that. One of them is good. One of them is bad. The answer to that is most of the psychiatric and other world is really, in my view, in denial. There are two answers. They're really in denial. The problem we have is the people, both the FDA, which approves drugs, and psychiatrists who prescribe them, really don't want to believe that it could cause this kind of bizarre and terribly harmful death. So they're in denial. And when people don't want to think about something, it's very, very hard to get something done. There are also a lot of other ways that we could study both violence and suicidal behaviors. We have all these legal cases. Thousands of legal cases have been settled, and there are elaborate medical histories available. So I think there is a lot. So the first part is denial, and the FDA is part of it. The second part is these cases are really, each individual case, they are really difficult. They're hard to investigate. Every case is, you know, an act has many factors. Sometimes people are taking multiple drugs. And so each case, because they're relatively rare, if you have something that happens to a lot of people, even up around 1%, it's not hard to find. It's not very hard to analyze that. But when you get something that's probably well under 1%, down to a fraction, and each case is complicated, that's tough. So one part denial, one part hard.
In terms of the complexity of the cases, there's no doubt about that. I think the best presentation of the complexity of those violence cases is my book, Medication Madness, in which I look at 50 cases of bizarre suicidal and violent behaviors, including some of the school shootings where I've been an expert. So medication madness does give you a broad view. It's very hard to get any data about settled cases. They usually, as you know, Tom, they're quarantined, all the information. And then for a really wonderful look at, if you call it wonderful, at one particular case, again, Andrew's Speed Kills film is just amazing. It's just a great film. And go watch it on YouTube. It's a very, very, very good film. Well, there's a lot to talk about, even more than we can cover here about violence. Is there? I wouldn't mind just staying on this violence theme. Let me have a suggestion for a related topic
that's close, which is another study that I've done and published in a medical journal. So let's talk about a different form of bizarre behavior. And actually, this one is easier to do. So I have published it. So there are a family of drugs that are given either to people with restless legs syndrome. Believe it or not, there are a lot of people with this disorder. Or Parkinson's disease. And they are called dopamine receptor agonists. And so what they do is they take people with Parkinson's disease, of course, are losing their dopamine-producing cells. They take those receptors in a particular kind, D3 receptors, and they make them much more sensitive. That's what they're doing. That's their job. So I wrote a paper, and here is a case of a different form of bizarre, but plenty bizarre, but much more frequent than violence. And here's what these drugs cause. They cause pathological gambling, hypersexuality, and compulsive shopping. Now, it's not like they cause not other types of loss of impulse control. And this is one of this has been litigated, and there's still some litigation going on about it. So there are really a lot of cases, The individual stories are striking. Someone, you know, who had been prudent and never had any interest in gambling suddenly goes out in 2 months' time, gambles away a $100,000 inheritance. A minister who's had a totally upright life, his entire life, within weeks of starting a dopamine receptor agonist, suddenly starts propositioning all the women in his congregation. Truly extraordinary individual stories. This has been litigated, interestingly enough, for Mirapex. The other part is a few neurologists got interested in this, and they wondered how frequently does this happen? And the answers came back shockingly, like around 10%. And even those were kind of simple surveys. So what's interesting about this in terms of drugs and bizarre behaviors is, one, we have a particular receptor, the dopamine D3 receptor, and two, we have a very specific, narrowly defined pattern of impulse control. Pathological gambling, hypersexuality, compulsive shopping, and something called poriomania, which means just obsessively twisting your hair, basically. And it happens very frequently. So here, we actually, much of this business about serotonin and reuptake, and I think you've been into that, is scientifically very dubious. But here, we actually have a biochemical mechanism where we have a particular receptor, we have drugs that affect it, and we have a very clearly identifiable pattern of behavior in people who were not mentally ill. I mean, they had restless leg syndromes. And so it's a very clear case. It's the clearest case I know of that links a specific chemical, biochemical drug effect to a specific pattern of bizarre behavior. The last story, and these cases are now going to be going on trial, of the antipsychotic drugs, the drugs for schizophrenia, only one prominently affects, and it actually has this effect on the similar type effect, a little milder, on the D3 receptor. And of the antipsychotic drugs, only one drug, Abilify, has a ton of reported cases of pathological gambling, hypersexuality, and compulsive shopping. And that is a big mass tort. That is probably going to trial. And the FDA put warnings on the drug about this, partly as a result of the paper that I wrote. So at least as we're moving down the track here of talking about bizarre behaviors, it's a clear-cut case. People without a pre-existing or other mental illness to a very specific pattern of behavior, and three, a very narrowly defined chemical pathway through which the drug acts.
I think this is very, very interesting. Folks, I think that you're privileged to hear this discussion. It raises so many interesting issues about human nature and human behavior that are beyond the few minutes, the 15 approximately minutes we have left. I suspect that if we looked at these behaviors, you know, as clinicians and really had the cases in front of us or talked to these people and weren't just out to show that these specific behaviors happened, we'd find that these people are probably, I'm not, by the way, rejecting how this very specific behavior is occurring, but it is occurring. But you'd also find out that there's a lot of other manic-like and obsessive-like things going on that are more falling below the radar, because it's probably more of a spectrum, but it's also, I'm certain what you're saying is correct, that there's this strange overload and for both of those drugs of these effects. And Abilify has a mixed effect on dopamine. It's not as simple an effect as the other antipsychotic drugs. So it may be that something about that mixed effect it's having is similar, you know, to the effects that you're getting from these anti-Parkinsonian drugs and, you know, anti-restless leg drugs. Abilify, again, I don't know that we know why, but Abilify is extremely commonly produces another terrible thing, akathisia, which is the inability to sit still, and restless legs. I mean, that's interesting because it produces a restless leg syndrome, akathisia in this case, which is just an inner torture that makes you feel like moving your body around. Go ahead.
I would just add to your akathisia, and it's shared by other antipsychotic drugs. I just sort of want to dramatize for your listener what kind of torture this is. These are individuals who literally can't be content in their skin. They can't sit down. They are constantly restless. It's associated with some people kill themselves or attempt to kill themselves just to stop this feeling. Akathisia is a very problematical adverse effect. It's another sort of
it goes along a continuum. There's some very good studies about it by a fellow named Van Putten. If you look up Van Putten, you'll get to these studies where he honestly examines how even being a little jittery, the mild minimal akathisia, keeps people from working, keeps them from being able to be creative, from relaxing, from having a decent quality of life. And I've had legal cases, folks, and the one that comes to my mind is a teenager who couldn't stop running around the kitchen. What do you call those things, Tom, that are in the middle of a kitchen?
The island.
He couldn't stop running around the island of his kitchen. And if you really urged him to stop and you sort of stood there with him, he would just go into anguish in the effort to try to stop. So, I mean, here are drugs that it's almost impossible to prove they help. And it is impossible to avoid seeing the huge amount of harm they do. I have a little bit more of a more worse view of the violence issue, I think, than you do, Tom, in that certainly things like mass shootings and murders are rare, but I believe that a lot of akathisia from the antidepressants and from the antipsychotic drugs make people very aggressive and nasty and mean because they just feel horrible and they can't tell you why. And in studies of children by advocates that were done, these are all covered in my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. The first half covers you know, the studies, including Tom's. Children, you know, a third or more, a half, and will get some sort of social disability where they're just not in touch, they're not caring, they're aggressive, they're agitated. And studies of the antidepressants, even by the drug companies themselves, have shown rates of two-thirds of people getting agitated on Prozac, for example. So while the events of severe violence are rare, thank God, making people upset, angry, and irritable, I don't think is rare at all. What do you think, Tom?
Well, antidepressants are—I call them a chemical bull in a china shop. And they seemed, and because they have paradoxical effects, they're, if we take antidepressants, and they cause anxiety, agitation, overstimulations, inability to sleep, agitation, anxiety. Whether technically it meets the akathisia description, I don't know. But certainly it does that. The second contradictory side of this is about, most estimates I've seen was about a third. So we're talking about, again, we're not talking about something rare. We're talking about something common. But the other part about that is a slightly smaller number, maybe 20, 25%. It flattens them out. It flattens them out. They are dopey. They sometimes, in many cases, they feel like they're observing themselves from afar. Depersonalization, somnolence, and so that's one of the other problems with antidepressant drugs, which is it pushes people both ways. So yes, I would agree with you that it has the stimulant agitation completely on one set of group of people. Whether that then links to violence, I am speculating. I am guessing something else goes on that but I have not been able to, we haven't got enough cases. I think that there are some people for whom these drugs are just poison, that and I don't think we know enough to pick them out.
Oh, I think they're poisonous to everybody, Tom, and just some people get it worse. And that would be true if you took a little bit of arsenic. Some people will do much better with it, some people will do worse. I don't think it's so specific as it's a spectrum, you know. It's a bell curve of people who get it worse and people who don't get it worse. And we see that biologically. So I suspect that's all it is. But you may be right that there's some other way to fine-tune it someday. But, you know, same with a blow on the head, you know. You blow on the head will affect some people some way and other people other ways. So my view, and I've written about it in one of my blogs, one of my best blogs on Mad in America, I think, and where I say, what shall we call psychiatric drugs? And I say, we should just call them neurotoxins. Let's call them neurotoxins. And then we understand everything that's going to happen. We can understand that the longer you're on them, the worse you're going to get, that in the long run it won't do you any good at all. In the short run, it might blunt you and you feel better, or you might get high and you'll feel better, but it's because of damage. So I think the brain disabling effect that I described decades ago and have kept refining, in fact, these drugs all work by disabling the brain, and all are essentially neurotoxins. And not neurotoxins in the same sense that, say, a cardiac toxin might help the heart temporarily or even long-term by slowing down an arrhythmia. Because when you when you cause a partial harm to the heart in order to slow down an arrhythmia, you're not changing the personality and character of the individual. When you give a neurotoxin to somebody, you're changing the character, personality, the abilities, the quality of life of the individual. So, I'm so glad you're doing what you're doing. I mean, Tom Lurie, folks, is just one of the very few scientists out there that is putting his intelligence to work on adverse drug effects, and he's making major contributions. And I use his data in my books. I use his data in lawsuits. You're really valuable. I want to end. We have only a minute or two. I want to end with one more thought about the Dr. Oz show. So I made really clear in my talks with the producer at Dr. Oz what a disaster it was at Aurora, because the Aurora shooter, Holmes, went looking for help to the psychiatric clinic where this psychiatrist, who was an expert in the school violence, supposedly spotted right away he was dangerous, because he told her, "I'm so violent, I can't tell you how violent I am, or you'd lock me up." But he didn't lock her up. She didn't lock him up. What did she do with Holmes? Well, she reported him to the security people, but nothing was done. And then, on the first day, she started him on Zoloft. So she gives a drug, which if she'd read Tom Moore, she would have known was associated with violence, or read Peter Bregan, would have known was associated with violence, on his first day of saying he's so violent that he can't tell her. And she doesn't even have the skill to find out what it is, because he's obviously begging to tell her, or he wouldn't bring it up in the first place. And they exonerated her totally. They said that one thing we know is even the best psychiatrist, like the psychiatrist at Aurora shooter psychiatrist, did nothing wrong. She did nothing right. Tom, a closing thought?
Well,
real short.
It's a matter of, I've done a lot of work. You and I have similar but also divergent views. I think we can say that most psychiatric drugs, have very, very severe limitations, that their toxic effects are constantly underestimated, and their benefits, where they exist, are overestimated, and that anybody who's thinking that a pill is an answer to their mental health problem needs to look very carefully and very skeptically.
Tom. That is a perfect ending. We are going off the air. Folks, thanks for being there and listening to my frustration today over Dr. Oz. Bless you.